I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today I have a guest, Lakeisha Lockhart, who describes herself as a playful womanist scholar activist. She is currently the director of the Stream Youth Theology Institute and an assistant professor of practical theology at the Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology at the Virginia Union University. She is also a doctoral candidate at Boston College in the Theology and Education Department, working on her dissertation that I hope we'll get into, called Doing Double Dutch, Womanist Modes of Play as a Pedagogical Resource for Theological Education. Tongue twister. But thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And I know that those are mouthfuls, so don't feel bad. I stumble over them as well.
It's just like, don't make me say that 10 times really fast.
That's always the beauty of having someone else introduce you, because you don't have to say it often. So that's always exciting.
Oh my. Well, I was really impressed with some of the things you're involved with, and I hope we can run through them. But what drew you to things like being involved with ARC? And maybe you can describe what ARC is and what that involves. That's how I found you on that website.
Absolutely. So ARC, Arts, Religion, and Culture. And it's an organization. We're a community, a creative community for theopoetics. We're people who believe in cultivating embodied and just ways of knowing and being through artistic and spiritual practices, you know, in order to make a more just world so that everyone can flourish in all creation, regardless of your gender, your race, all the things that sometimes hold us back from seeing the other. And I just got involved with that, as a being a woman of color. I've never not known a time where my body didn't matter. And so it's always, you know, it's always been here, whether I've wanted it to have comments made or not. It's always been an issue. It's always been a thing. And so I guess it just kind of around college, I decided to take that into my own hands instead of letting other people name it and claim it for me. I claimed it for myself. And so I just got into a lot of the body. I was always kind of into sports, but I was into dance and movement, and I started teaching Zumba, and I just this sense of my body being this a wonderful, beautiful thing that I don't have to hide, that I don't have to squelch down to make other people feel bigger, that I just get to be and do, and that I have different ways of being in the world and knowing and exploring, you know, the divine, creation, myself, my family, others, and that it was welcome, right? Because for so long I thought it wasn't. And so then I got interested because I'm like, oh, these are the things I'm interested in. There are people that are actually interested in these things. Oh, these are my people. And so, I was like, oh my gosh, your bodies matter to you too. You believe in other ways of knowing than just, you know, in a book, that you believe in creativity and spirituality and imagination. Yes, you are my people. Let's do this thing. And so that's really how it started. Just a group of people that were like, hey, we're each other's people. Let's do this thing and let other people know that we value other things like creativity and spirituality. There are more ways to do this thing than just one. And so that's kind of my main.
Yeah, well, the great thing about theopoetics, and I cover this in a couple other episodes too, that if listeners are not used to that term theopoetics, there's some other episodes to look back on, but I'll read this from the brochure. ARC is a creative collaborative for theopoetics, and it says theopoetics is a word for the place where justice-seeking religious reflection intersects with spirituality, imagination, the arts, and embodiment. It is a way to do religious reflection that gives greater attention to form, genre, and method. It validates art, experience, and the body as a means of religious reflection and is concerned with legitimating the pre-rational and supporting concrete change. Art and faith matter.
Yeah. And isn't that such a great definition? And it's a little long. And so I think, no, but I guess the one thing I just to take away is that theopoetics isn't just any one thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, that's a great definition. It's wonderful. But guess what? If you have this amazing body and you want to think, you want to imagine, those are all types of theopoetics. So it's not just for one person or one group of people. It's open for everyone. And we have on our website, artsreligionculture.org, we have this really awesome banner that we have. And what it does is it talks us through like all the things we kind of envision, right? Mm-hmm. So we have what theopoetics is, but it's like, you know, we name systems of power and privilege. You know, we are about dancers, doers, and makers. We're about the stuff that makes up the play and makes up mourning. I mean, it's all part of life and how we make sense of the world and how we do this thing. So your way of knowing and being and your embodiedness in the world is just as important as mine. So it's all still kind of what you make of it too. So it's a great definition, but don't feel like it's the end all be all, because it's so much more. It's
there's a lot of room in that definition for all kinds of applications and ways of being within that. And I one of the things I was mentioning to Khaled in our conversation is sometimes beauty and art is seen in these sort of typical ways, and you don't see other kinds of people and other kinds of bodies and other kinds of ways of being as ever being represented. Like, I have a special needs son, and you don't see special needs people as embodied often in art or as beautiful things or, you know, beautiful creatures in the world. And this makes room for anyone in any way to be expressive of those types of things. And I think, and a lot of times we don't even know we're blind to those things. I think, and that that's kind of where the work of what womanist theology is about too. It's like there's a lot of just insensitivity in the sense like, oh wait, I was only learning one perspective of theology. Or what, you know, when my when I got my degree, it was in religion, but it actually wasn't in religion. It was just in Christianity. I didn't study Buddhism, and it wasn't just in Christianity. It was males who had developed this, and it wasn't just males. It was Western males, and it was white Western males. Pretty narrow. There were very few contributions from anyone else outside that really narrow scope, and which is fine. It's just that would have been really long on a diploma, I suppose. But but it would be better if we admitted that and then allowed plenty of other voices and perspectives to play in and weigh in.
No, absolutely. And I guess kind of, so, you know, I do reign in the academic world, right? So I'm I'm there. That's where, you know, the dissertation, I'm teaching. And so I do live in this academic world, and ARC allows me this beautiful space to kind of have my academic side, but also my practical side, and reminds me like to stay grounded in the work, right? In the collective community, collaborative building that this work is, that sometimes what I've found and why I've chosen to kind of do this work is to push back a little bit, again, challenge the academy actually in the work that I do. Because, you know, as you mentioned, it's, you know, it's called Doing Double Dutch, Womanish Modes of Play as a Pedagogical Tool or Resource for Theological Education. And so, and a lot of that is about being able to make space for everyone at the table, right? Being being a black woman in the academy, especially in theological education, not a whole lot of faces that look like mine, not a whole lot of bodies that look like mine.
Right.
You know, maybe one here or there, but very few and far between. And most of the time, I just kind of, you know, we're reading these, you know, dead, old, white men, you know, who were in the Gadamers and the Charles Taylors. And yeah, they have really great things to say, but they don't make what I've come to find is I don't feel like they make space for all of the other bodies that are in this world, all of the other ways of doing this thing, all of the other people and doing that. And so what I believe womanism is really just kind of, you know, realizing that Black women's experience, African American women's experience matters, right? That it has this wonderful, beautiful way of pushing back against struggle and all the things that we've been through in this country, and that we can persevere, that we flourish, that we are strong and we go on, and saying that, you know what, our narrative matters, that not just the dominant white, male, Western, Christian, European narrative, but our narrative matters too. And if our narrative matters, then everyone's narrative matters, you know? And so while it starts with a very Black woman's focus with our narrative and our experience, what it does is it says that we push for the flourishing and of all people, right? That's definitely one of the womanist tenets, is that we strive for everyone to feel like they can be embodied, that their bodies are wonderful and amazing, their livelihood, their person, their experiences, and all of their being matter. And I think that's huge in the academy, where we're not always told that. where the work that we're doing doesn't always match up, or we're not always able to be embodied in the work that we do. We just have to be heads kind of floating around sometimes. And I like to push back against that. I like to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell me what you do with Stream UTI and what that involves.
Oh, yeah. So I love. OK, so so Stream Youth Theology Institute is funded in part by Lilly Endowment, which is awesome. So thanks. Shout out to Lilly. But what it does, it works with high school youth ages, high school juniors and seniors. And in our area, because I work at Virginia Union University, which is a historically Black institution. And so most of our students are students of color. And so we get them and we actually get to spend a week together really wrestling about what it means to live out our faith in the world as people that believe in a creator, but also as Black persons in the world, and especially in the current world that we live in, you know, the different climates that are going on in the world. And so we get to spend a week talking to these youth about identity formation. You know, who are you? They actually take Myers-Briggs, right? Because we try to teach them how you make decisions and how you do these things. It matters what your value systems are. They matter and what happens, right? Because they're at this very delicate place where they're about to transition into the next stage of life, whatever that may be. And some of them are nervous or scared. And we just try to give them tools to help empower them to live out their faith, whatever that means. That doesn't mean they're going to be pastors. That means they might want to be biologists. But guess what? That still involves a level of ethics and morals that they're going to take with them. And so, you know, we walk the slave trail. We talk about our history, our heritage, especially as Black persons in this country, and how that might look different in different spaces. We talk about social justice and how important it is to, you know, push and to do what's just in the world, and how sometimes that might not always be in our favor sometimes. And so, yeah. And so I can't even begin to tell you how amazing these young people are. I mean, they just bless my whole soul. I mean, to the point where we still do GroupMe chats, like, because, you know, when we're there for the week, we do GroupMe because I try not to let them do too much extra phone stuff. Although we do encourage social media because, hey, that's the age we're living in. And so we do a GroupMe and we still have the GroupMe, and they still send all of these kinds of really great things to think about when, you know, the stuff happened in Charlottesville. They were sending messages like, what are we doing? And they're like, not just what are we doing? What are the clergy doing? Who's preaching about this? Who's talking? And I'm like, these are high school kids. And I'm like, just exactly. And I'm like, yes, these are things that we need to be talking about. There's an injustice that's happened. What are we doing? We can't just stay dormant. Like, it's about being practical, moving those ways of knowing, you know, just the doing of the thing, not just the thing itself, but the doing and the being and the moving of it. And they get that. And it's so good. It's so good. So I love how all of my interests get to intertwine and all the work that I do. It's amazing.
Yeah. And you sound so proud of those kids. That's awesome.
They're so amazing.
And that's the best part about being a teacher, and you're investing, and then you see those little lights go on in their hearts or in their minds or both, and you notice that things are clicking and things are making a difference for them. And it's part of the embodiment too, is the action, and seeing them ask important questions and ask, what's my part to play?
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. And just one of the things that we also do is we spend a day just talking about the body, right? Because I believe in the body. But for so many of them, all they were told is that their body, they just need to deny their flesh, and that their body is not something to be celebrated. For the girls, you know, you're just a distraction. For the boys, so you need to cover up. And, you know, the only times our bodies were there for them, the only times their bodies were ever really seen as good was, you know, if, you know, Deacon or Sister Sosa wanted to give them a hug, or if they, and so it just brought up so many dynamics around the body and how we carry ourselves. And so we spent a day doing we invited Tiffany Trent, who's amazing and does a lot of Augusto Boal's Theater of the Oppressed with them. And when I tell you, it was one of the most moving things I had ever seen, to have, you know, the youth put themselves in the position of a Jesus character or a Mary or different characters, right? And try to reenact things and actually live within their bodies, actually move. They were crawling, they were doing, and for them, that was the first time they had ever engaged scripture in their bodies. Ever at one point, and seen it done in a positive and exciting way. And so when I tell you, like, there were real tears because it was just so beautiful for them to be embodied and empowered in that way, for them not to see their bodies as criminal or dangerous or objects of affection, but to be empowered tools to do this work. It was amazing. And that's exactly what I mean, at least in my dissertation, that's exactly what a lot of my work pushes to do, is to push these modes of play so that our bodies are not just seen as objects or mm-hmm. criminal or dangerous, but of so much more, as beings that are fully made in this amazing image mm-hmm. of a creator that can do this great work. So yeah, it's amazing.
What you're talking about, and I hope I can get maybe a link to what you're speaking of, what you mentioned, or something like that, to dig into it a little further. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that sounds really amazing and really transformative. But yeah. What you're speaking of about bodies and different ways of encountering them, especially like as a teenager, and I know just from my own experience, like self-loathing and then feeling objectified mm-hmm. by culture most of the time. And I know that that's true culturally in the United yeah. States, but I know that among Black women, feeling objectified in culture and music and just mm-hmm. like everybody else, but maybe in a specially degrading way, can happen. And just other ways of how stereotypes happen, negative stereotypes can happen, and that can be very, obviously, incredibly damaging and oppressive, that young adults can have these extremely warped senses of themselves, and then distance, you know, feel disassociated from their bodies and not feel that they can embrace themselves then.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I remember one of our, like this past summer, because we do it for a week in the summer in July. This year we're doing it July 8th through 14th. And so one of the things last summer that was really huge is that, you know, they felt like they weren't enough, mm. right? That they felt like just being who they were wasn't enough. Like they needed to be more or do more. And so we really focused on most of that week just reiterating that, no, you are enough just the way you are. And you know, a lot of that is because, you know, we've bought into this narrative, right? This, you know, if I'm, when I do the double Dutch thing, I use, analogies, I use jump rope to talk about kind of this one common narrative, right? This one white male Western narrative, this mm-hmm. one white male Western rope that we're all expected to jump in one specific way. Mm. But if we were not built for that rope was never intended or made for us. How are we supposed to jump that rope? You know, how are we supposed to do this thing that is foreign to us, or, you know, that's not, but, you know, you go to any academic setting, we're expected to know all the white scholars and very little colored scholars. And for so many of these youth, it was just, you know, I'm not enough because this is the dominant rope that I've been told I have to jump. This is what it means to be successful. This is what it means to be enough. And we just had to reiterate, no, you're enough just the way you are. Guess what? You can be enough and be a good Christian and still listen to Jay-Z. but we had to have those conversations because there were so many areas where they felt like they just, it wasn't it, or it wasn't what the world was telling them that they were supposed to be or supposed to do. And then, you know, Black bodies and death. And I mean, just so many conversations, but just more than anything, that they were enough, regardless of what the dominant narrative is putting out there, they are enough. And that was huge. That was huge this summer.
Yeah. So go into a little bit of the symbolism in your dissertation, because we're going ahead of it, and it's so juicy. we should just dive in. And so let's get back to the title, just even the title. So it's doing double Dutch: womanish modes of play as a pedagogical resource. let me just butcher that again. Pedagogical resource for theological education. So this relates to education, mm-hmm. and really understanding that there's kind of this double Dutch, you know, for people who don't know, it's jumping rope with two ropes. And, you know, we used to see it on Sesame Street. I don't even know if our kids double Dutching anymore. Are they just doing video games and doing Instagram? I don't even know. But
I think we all do a little more double Dutch. No, this is my dissertation. It's hopefully I'll be defending early next year. So, you know, please take all of that. So everyone listening, this isn't in its final form, but it's my baby. And so hopefully you'll treat it with care. So the images that I give is like this doing double Dutch, because a lot of it's about play. So it's, you know, because I believe when we move our bodies and when we play, we see the other, not as we want them to be, but exactly as they are. So I use double Dutch's images. And as I mentioned, I start with a jump rope. And I say, you know, in the United States and in the academy, there's been this historical reality that is this jump rope. it is this, you know, white Western male Christian rope that we're all expected to jump. If we can't jump it, we're not successful. If we can't jump this rope, then we're not deemed intelligent. If we can't jump this particular rope, then, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it makes it very difficult for those that do not identify or know how to jump this particular rope, right? Especially when the rope was never intended for any person of color or a woman or any of these, or a transgender, or, you know, I mean, it was never intended for any of the other bodies to jump this rope. And so it becomes very difficult to do this work. And what I find is I think theological education has this unique, and I would even say prophetic, opportunity to be an advocate for adding an additional rope. And I push for adding a womanist rope because, for, as I mentioned earlier, like within womanism, although we talk about the Black experience and narrative mattering, what we're also saying, well, excuse me, Black woman's experience and narrative mattering, what it's also saying is we, all other experiences matter. All the other narratives that are not the main narrative, they matter too, right? That those voices matter and that all of us should be here together trying to flourish and trying to push each other and trying to do this great thing and striving for justice, pushing back against the injustices in the world so that all narratives can be seen as valid and worthy. And all of these embodied ways of knowing are equally held high and important, not just the dead white scholars that you have to know and memorize, but our embodied ways of knowing, of dance, of being, matter too. And so that's all what this womanist rope does. And so I'm not saying we get rid of the jump rope, because I don't think that's actually possible. So I don't want to be crazy when I say that. What I'm saying is adding another rope. When you add this womanist rope and we start doing double dutch together, so we're turning two ropes at the same time, which is extremely difficult, right? But guess what? It was jumping one rope was extremely difficult for people whose rope it wasn't meant for. But if we can all get on this page and we can all do take both of these ropes and jump them together, we can learn about our white scholars, but we can also learn about a lot of our global scholars of color, right? We can do that together. Like, let's put those voices together, because I guarantee you they're going to have new perspectives, new insights, new things to share that we can all benefit from. Because the more voices we have in our toolbox, the more voices we have around the table, more bodies we have, the more we can begin to grow and see and understand. And one of the big things I advocate for is so we can begin to teach across difference, mm-hmm. right? I've been in so many classrooms where there is not one person of color on the syllabus. There is not one other global perspective. And for me, how do you begin to teach across difference in a classroom with people that have other cultural backgrounds when you are only using one main narrative? We have to open this up. And once we do, we begin to see, and then a lot of these isms, the racisms, the sexisms, I'm not saying that they'll be alleviated, but they're going to be seen and they can be pushed back because we'll call them out in a different way, because we're caring for each other in different ways. So that's my hope anyway. I mean, I know it sounds lofty, but that is my hope. And
well, it's really important to at least first, just get the message out. I think you're missing a lot of people. You're missing a lot of voices. And it's very obvious. What's surprising to me is that people don't think there's missing voices. So my parents met at seminary, but my dad was the only brown guy there, Puerto Rican guy. And when my white mom wanted to marry him, someone said to him, "You can't marry him, it'll be an interracial marriage and your kids will really suffer." And my mom was like, "What?"
Yeah,
but but it's like, you know, he was like, "I'm not different. I'm born in Brooklyn. I'm not really Puerto Rican." You know, he didn't really think of himself as very different, but everybody thought of him as different, you know. And it's just interesting, though, going to such a white place to learn. Even his subtle difference was considered so different, but there wasn't any, remotely any other voices being heard, but they didn't think of that as strange.
I know. And for me, that's part of the problem, right? Is mm-hmm. that if you don't like, I need you to first realize that this is an issue.
Yeah.
And so me using this image is hopefully getting people to see that there can be another rope. That we can add another one, I promise you. And the world will not cave in. It will not go crazy. It will not shut down, but it will be made better, mm-hmm. right? Because we can have a different type of consciousness, right? We can be advocates for agency and identity formation. We can hold each other accountable. We can mm-hmm. push for freedom of embodiment and expression. We can be critical of injustices and systems of oppression if we allow these other voices to come in, right? Mm-hmm. Emily Towns talks a little bit about this fantastic hegemonic imagination. And what that basically is that, you know, for so long it's in this country that we've been told that there's with one dominant narrative. And because of this dominant narrative, it's affected our entire imagination so that we can't imagine anything more. We can't imagine another narrative because this dominant narrative has basically kind of taken over and taken hold and taken root, that this is the only imagination. This is the only narrative that matters. And what womanism does is it pushes back and says, no, there's another narrative. And here it is. And guess what? We can see other narratives with our Latina sisters, with our, you know, Native Americans. We get with, I mean, you name it. There are so many other cultures in this country that we can learn from and glean from that have different consciousnesses and different types of awarenesses that we can learn from. And it's like until we, and it's a part of the thing is that we have to start bringing people to the table, because if we're all faculty who are all, you know, white, mm-hmm. and we're all at the table, of course we're not bringing these voices because they're not our experience. Mm-hmm. And so we have to, it has to start like at an institutional level. I mean, the work I'm doing is I'm starting in the classroom, but my hope eventually, I guess in life, is to kind of move up within that and like try to make some change at institutional levels, because that's what has to start. It has to start by who we're hiring, mm-hmm. who's teaching, who's doing this work, and what are they actually teaching in the curriculum in their classrooms? Because I believe that this mode of play, which I do in my classrooms, I do a lot of womanish modes of play. I do kitchen table conversations. I do going outside and jumping. I mean, we play. We do Play-Doh. We do. but they're learning about each other and the creator, and we're still doing a really good work at the same time. That's rigorous, intellectually rigorous, but at the same time learning and culturally expressive. And it's these aesthetic experiences and ways of knowing and being and making help us make meaning of the world in real and practical ways that we can actually use in our lives. Yeah, and I'm like, that's just what we need, and I'm trying to get there, but it'll take a while because I mean, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work because I mean, I still get people now that tell me I need to write more white. So I mean, it's still just you know, it's going to be a constant struggle. But I'm like, you know, I'm sure there are women before me, especially Black women, that had it so much worse. So I'm like, I can still do this.
Well, I want to ask you a question then. So you are a professor at a historically Black institution. Do you want to continue working there, or do you think that you do you feel called to go to a place and that will diversify another place?
I feel like for right now that's exactly where I'm called to be. I feel like I'm getting my dissertation right now at a predominantly white institution, and God definitely knew what was going on, sending me to VUU, just because it's given my soul so much life. Because with the work that I'm doing, it's actually being lived out every day. I don't have to continuously be questioned for why does this matter? Why does this matter? Why does this voice need to be heard? But they get that important because they're living it every day. They're living the struggles. They're living these injustices every day. Mm-hmm. And so it's nothing weird to say, let's push back against these systems of oppression. And they're like, yes, let's do it. Mm-hmm. So it's wonderful. As far as future wise, we'll see where that leads me. I'm open, just because I know with this work, I can absolutely say it in an HBCU and do this good work. But I think that predominantly white institutions need this work too. Mm-hmm. They need to know that voices need to be around the table. And if that's kind of where I'm called, I will go and I will I'll fight the good fight.
Yeah.
I would like to say I'm going to dance. I'll help them dance with me. Maybe that's a better. I like that one better.
I'm not a
violent person, so I'm gonna go with dance. We'll dance together. I'll teach them the dance, and they can learn their own dance, and they can do their own dance eventually. So we'll have good fun.
Yeah, playful to be playful with each other. Right? And I think I'd like to know what you think, because asking the right questions is a great start for people. Like, are we hearing from everybody that we should be hearing from? Are we are we diverse enough in our teachers? Are we diverse enough in our staff? And what do you think are some things that people can do who, you know, you don't know your blind spots because they're blind spots, right? what can people do to do it better?
So many things. Of course, we know there are always great books, right? So the books are always a great thing. But I think there's nothing more valuable than actual people and experiences. Mm-hmm. And I would say, I guarantee you, even if you don't have them on the faculty, you have them in your student body somewhere. ask them questions. I do this thing, you know, my when I begin class, I have them fill out a get to know you thing, before classes start. And then the first day I help co-create a syllabus. So I have most of the syllabus done, but I leave a lot of it open so that we can co-create together. Because I want to know what voices they want to hear from. Mm-hmm. I want to know who they're looking forward to reading. Like, what are some goals that they hope to achieve? And my thing is that ask them. Talk to these other folks of color. Talk to them. And I guarantee you, they'll let you know that, hey, how there aren't any of these people. Mm-hmm. On our syllabus. What happened to these folks? Or do you know that there's a community in this particular area that's doing really good work? What if we bring them in? Or what if we go visit? I mean, I think people are huge resources. And I feel like so often we go in thinking that we're just dispensing knowledge to students when in fact, I think we're just sojourners on this journey with them, right? Or co-journers. Mm-hmm. Or we're here with them. We all have this great wealth of knowledge and we need to be sharing it. And what does it mean to make that a space of mutuality? So definitely asking the questions to them personally, to your community, who you have, who they want to hear from. I would actually say, and this, I mean this very literally, when you're at like, you know, meetings or you have those, you know, those big conversations where they're like the important people are at the table, literally sit down and write, how many of each gender, of each race? I mean, I know gender is not always something that you can visually see all the time, but even just color, like, you know, write all of that down. And like literally like sit there and take a percentage. My thing is, if you don't at least have 30%, and I mean, this is like minimum, right? Mm. At least 30%, then there might need to be some reevaluation or at least bring it up, right? Like, hey, you know, we're a table full of all, you know, white men, maybe one white woman and maybe one Native American. What voices aren't we hearing? You know what I mean? Like, what would it mean to go out and actually ask those questions? And then, you know, so those, I guess those are my two big things. And get involved, right? Other organizations can help you do this stuff. I mean, hello, ARC, we're wonderful. We actually, we kind of go out and we help educate educators about some of this stuff. So we really go out and we do workshops. We do this really good work. But there are lots of other organizations that I know that kind of do this. So if you don't know exactly the first steps to take, that's okay. Get someone, bring someone in to help you, get a consultant, get people in to come in, and help you do this work. And hopefully and preferably you won't just put all that work on the people of color. Cause that's often what happens so often. So I would definitely push to say that we can do this work. We can ask questions, but also remember to be sensitive to, the folks of color that we have in our, to not to always make them do the hard work. Cause guess what? We can learn too without having to always go and ask them. So let's do our research. Let's read our books. Let's talk to people. Let's engage. Let's build community and collaborate creatively. And not only that, but push your own self to imagine something more. And I think sometimes that's most difficult because if we have this one narrative, we don't really give ourselves boundaries to imagine more. But I would say sometimes imagine what something more can be and let yourself just mind run away with it and see what happens. I guarantee you it'll be amazing.
I know we're really up against the clock here. Maybe just our final question is that when you talk about play, that's a very joyful thing, right? And it's full of exuberance and something very, I mean, joy is kind of lacking because it can be in our culture and along these lines, because it can be full of hopelessness and despair and things aren't going very well. And the element of joy and play, how does that figure into this entire pursuit for you?
So play and joy, I mean, it's what has given me life so often in spaces where I have been harassed, in spaces where I have experienced extreme racism, in spaces where I've experienced ridiculous sexism. I mean, just all the spaces, being able to go back to this play and kind of taking this joyful kind of practice to life has been just transformative for me. And one of the main things why I really want to write about it is because I believe play can be that space in the classroom when all of the isms happen that go unchallenged, which they often do in classrooms. Play helps us bring us to a better space, right? So, I mean, I think if we, you know, and I know we like to say, oh, play is for kids. No, it's for adults too. We've just lost it along the way. Mm. But I guarantee you, if we pick it back up, it can be great. But especially for women of color, you know, I was raised playing cards, playing games, double dutch, dance. And so I had all of these mechanisms. So when I needed to cope, or whether it's joyful or mourning, like I was still playing. It's all of that. It's, you know, play helps you lament. It helps you grieve. It helps you do all of these things. But if we haven't learned these mechanisms growing up, it can be very difficult. So that's why I find play so just rejuvenating, because it's great for those joyful moments. But guess what? When I'm not feeling it, play gives me that space at the same time too. But, you know, and every culture plays different. And so I think if we can learn and build upon that, I think it can, you know, I'm not saying we need to be happy and joyful all the time, because there is a space for lament, but saying that play can help us cultivate that, can help us with these aesthetic experiences, help us express who we are, have these ways of knowing and being and making meaning in the world with each other collaboratively instead of in isolation. So, yeah.
We could probably do a whole episode on that. I want you to come back, Lakeisha, and talk with me again, will you?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted. This is the stuff I live for, if you can't tell. So I could talk about it all day long. So I'm sorry I talk so long.
No, I love it. Tell people where are a few places they can find you if they want to talk to you more, have you over to speak at their place.
Yeah, feel free. Hey, if you want me, I'm here. If not, I got a group of people at ARC. So for me personally, my email is lrlockhart. So it's lrlockhart at VUU.edu. That's my email at Virginia Union University. I'm on Facebook, Lakeisha Lockhart. I am also stream the Youth Theology Institute. If you want to come and hang out or talk more about it, it's www.streamyty.com. And then last but certainly not least, ARC. It's artsreligionculture.org. So just like it sounds, artsreligionculture.org. And we have a conference in Boston in March. So if you're in the area, feel free to come in, check us out. But yeah, so those are the ways to contact me. And feel free, I'm happy to answer any questions or just have a chat. I love talking, and or we can get coffee or we can go dance or do Zumba. Let's make it a full body thing.
Thanks, Lakeisha. This will be out on the 24th of January, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. You have a great day. Thank you.
Yes, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. Patreon is like patron with an E. Patreon.com/SparkMyMuse. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.